Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Graeme Hart Show with Nate Breiser here on Cornwall Revolution Radio and out of grism.blogspot.com, where Mammy welcomes you to the best news aggregate site on the World Wide Web. It's good to have your company, folks. So if you'd like to join us in the chat room, please click on the HTML5 chat link on the top right-hand side of the page, just below the player of your choice. So yes, now, Monday the 28th of January, we're only nearly 1 month into 2019, and it's getting crazier than ever. But we're going to continue anyway, trying to put out some good shows, get some good guests on. Tonight we're going to talk about communitarianism. I'm sure some of you might have heard about this, but I'm going to let our guests really kind of go into the meat and bones of this, because this is affecting us. This is right under our very noses, folks. So everything that's going on around you, pretty much everything that's going on around you, is all rooted in communitarianism. And no better man to talk about this. He's been on many radio shows. He's written a lot on his blog about it. There's lots of resources to look at there, lots of links. It's a deep topic, folks, but once you kind of get the basics of it, you can see it around you. You can see, when you get out there in the street, you can actually see this is happening. So I'd like to welcome tonight, it's afternoon for the man himself. He's Lark, and he's over there in Texas. Lark, how are you, sir?
Not too bad, Breiser. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, all good here. How's the weather treating you over there? We're hearing getting your climate change is having a detrimental effect on you over there, I believe, I hear.
Yeah, for one moment to the next, we're entering a new ice age, and global warming is impacting upon us all. It's it's the same as it's always been down here.
Yeah, it's surprising, like down in Texas, you wouldn't think you'd be getting weather like that, but there you go, you know. And yet over here in Ireland, it's cold here, but it's not. We got nothing like what you guys are getting, so, you know. Of course,
you realize Dallas, Texas is north central Texas, and this is a Sun Belt city, mm-hmm. And so we don't get it like the Rust Belt, the north and the northeast, in terms of winters. Yeah. In fact, I don't think we've seen any snow at all this winter season.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Lark, communitarianism. You've done a lot of research into this. You've spent many years at it. Fascinating stuff. I started finding out about this about 4 or 5 years ago when I came across this lady called Nikki Rapana, who's also done incredible work on this. Kind of lost focus on it for a bit, though, because of so many other things going on. But the more I get out there and look at what's going on now, I can see this is all unfolding now right in front of our faces. And it's, as I say, it's pretty deep. It's right there and it's insidious. It's affecting every part of our life. So I'll hand it over to you, and I'll jump in whenever I've got questions and whatever, but you're the man, so we'll hand you to the floor. So off you go.
Well, thank you. I'll try to do this. Communitarianism is important. It is a multisyllabic word, and it's difficult to say. But the thing to remember about any word that ends in ISM is that you can simply replace the words school of thought when you hear this, any ism. And generally, you're going to find this these words in academia and in textbooks and the like. You're seldom going to see or hear them discussed in public on your telly or in your newspapers and so forth. And the truth is most people's lives are ruled by events. And they don't realize the extent to which they are ruled by ideas. Events you can see, it's rooted in the sensory perceptions, taste, smell, touch, sight, etc. Mm-hmm. And ideas, we don't realize the extent to which they have impact upon our lives. So communitarianism has been described as a theory and or a school of thought which can be likened to a scientific dictatorship of the community. But community needs, the word community needs to be placed in air quotes. Mm-hmm. You know, bear in mind, if you were to look up the word communitarian in, say, a Webster's collegiate dictionary, say 1968, you're going to see that it's a synonym for a communist. But the fact is that communitarianism is not communism. It is actually a synthesis between communism and capitalism. And, of course, as we understand, both of these constructs today are really dominated by Jewish thought, both capitalism and communism. Mm-hmm. So I like to describe it or define it as simply communism or cultural Marxism combined with British mercantilism, what we call free trade, combines with crony monopoly bent capitalism equals communitarianism and or a scientific dictatorship of the global to local community. And bear in mind that word community in Hebrew is kahila. You can read an article on the internet. It's called The Importance of the Community, or Kehilla, K-E-H-I-L-L-A-H in parentheses, in Judaism. Yeah. And so communitarianism has also been defined as a so-called all-encompassing ism or school of thought. And this is where the insidious nature of it comes in, because it's rooted in something called communitarian law. Now, living in Europe as you do, perhaps you might have some familiarity with what's called community law in Europe because, of course, of the creation of the European Union. Well, yeah. Communitarian law is also known as EU law or European Union law, and this is a law that was more than 60 years in the making. Mm-hmm. Just consult any encyclopedia on EU law. Yeah. But EU law itself is rooted in what's known in the French as acquis communautaire. And in English, that translates simply as communitarian law. So, you know, the world is much smaller place today because of these so-called GRIN technologies. GRIN's an acronym for genetics, robotics, information, and nanotech. And just the nature of the personal computer, artificial intelligence, and computer sciences alone should tell us that the world is a smaller place because we have near instant communication media today. Mm-hmm. And this is something that wasn't true 30, 40 years ago. So this is why we see this stuff called communitarian law and communitarianism being rolled out so quickly right beneath our noses. Mm-hmm. And especially people our age, over 50, you know, this is quite a startling development. However, people that are under the age of 40 or 30, these people see it as quite normal because this is what they grew up with. You know, the curriculum in the schools was rooted towards this this idea that everyone should be a world citizen and a global change agent and the like. You see this in the mission statements of universities across the world. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's just quite natural. And there are people today that have not known life without access to a personal computer or a smart device. But if you have a multinational corporation, say in Germany, that's conducting business with another multinational corporation in the UK, and in turn, they have aspects of this contract fulfillment within their dealings with another multinational corporation in the US, and another one, say, in the People's Republic of China. And there happens to be a contract dispute that needed to be adjudicated in a court of law. Well, the question becomes, which law will hold? What type of a court will we settle this contract dispute? Mm-hmm. Well, back in the 90s, it was common to see a contract clause that was called supremacy of communitarian law. It was always in real tiny print. But this is the justification that these people have, these people in legal circles, to roll out a one world government that is rooted in one world law. And that's why we should take notice of this thing, because it does have impact upon our lives. In fact, it's so pervasive today that it affects every single one of us. At the end of the day, the way I see it, it can be likened to getting trapped into a spider's web. And you may have one foot outside of the spider's web and another foot trapped in the spider's web. And if you don't have a way to get away from the spider's web, because you still have that one foot outside the web, then, and you get drawn into the spider's web, then you have no choice but to flail around and wait for the spider to suck the life out of you. And this is how I liken this thing called the New World Order. But the law of the New World Order is communitarian law, and this is why we should be talking about it.
So, now you're right about the European thing, because we started off with the European Steel and Coal Community, I think it was, then it became the European Economic Community. There's that word community, obviously. Then it just became the European Community, and now it's the European Union. So it was kind of in our faces in a way, wasn't it? From way back
then. Yes, and I noticed that you and Graham and a goodly percentage of your listeners travel in so-called white nationalist circles. And I myself am a person who does not like labels. So I eschew labels. You might have heard it said that labels disable. And the reason that I don't attach myself to, for instance, white nationalist, is because of the fact that they have been infiltrated. In Europe, there's an article you can read on the internet. It's called Europe's Kosher Right-Wing Parties. Mm-hmm. And, this is happening in this country. So anytime you join or create a collectivist entity and it gains any kind of voice, measure of prominence, in other words, you're finding some success getting your word out, your message out, then there's a better chance that you're going to be infiltrated, because you'll become a target. And so we have to be concerned about these things. And to this day, I'm concerned that if I was to align myself with the white nationalists, well, why don't we have an effective communication platform? Because we have to ask ourselves, who owns the means of production? This is something that was integral to communist rule. It's also integral to capitalist rule, because capitalists are always bent on monopoly. And the reason they want monopolies is because they want guaranteed profits. And of course you would. And but the communists are the same way. You know, they want a monopoly on all means of production. And that includes the production of thought, production of communication, production of money, and everything else. So the truth is that communitarianism is really a totalitarian system.
So obviously, you know, we're all concerned about the mass immigration into Western countries at this moment in time. So the obvious reaction is the rise of what we call far-right parties. And we are seeing it across Europe. We're seeing it in Italy. We're seeing it in Austria and Germany, and some parts of Germany anyway, and Poland, you know. So is this part of the plan?
Is this, they were expecting this, is it?
Is this? Okay, of course. Yeah. See, the communitarians especially fond of Hegel, because Hegel felt that all power should go to the state. And, you know, what was named for him, perhaps falsely, is something called the Hegelian dialectic.
A lot of people know that. Problem, reaction, solution, we all know it as.
Right, or thesis versus or juxtapose against its antithesis to produce a synthesis. And, you know, you could also speak about proposal, counter-proposal. I mean, the thing about it is the Hegelian dialectic is not some external phenomenon only. It's also an internal phenomenon. And so they take advantage of these things. The behaviorists and the sociologists and the smart guys in the universities that, you know, eventually, you know, they study stuff like political science. And these subjects were formerly called pseudosciences. They're not sciences at all in terms of being true sciences. They're what we call soft sciences. And so, you know, man is one of the most studied creatures ever in history, because you know, there's always men that want to control other men for economic and political gain or advantage. But it's true that in Europe they have such a thing since 1950 called the Charlemagne Prize, and that prize was established. Yeah, exactly. To honor the contributions of practical idealism and Count Richard Coudenhove Kalergi. And all you have to do is look it up, Charlemagne Prize. And it's actually celebrated in Germany. And you can see some of the personages who've, you know, won that award. People like Henry Kissinger and Bill Clinton, Tony Blair.
Merkel, Angela Merkel.
Absolutely.
Sarkozy in France, yeah, there's a load of them. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of philosophy. I don't disconnect religion from philosophy. I term it religio philosophy. That you could talk about, you know, for days and days and days, and I have in the past talked about it for days and days and days. Even though I only consider myself a dilettante, I'm like that young kid in your elementary school class, you know, during show and tell. You know, it's where different students were called upon by the teacher to share something with the class that was a part of their experience in their lives, say, away from the classroom. And so I discovered things and I'm going, wow, I want other people to know about this. I want to talk about this. Why isn't anybody talking about this? So I'm like this kid running around going, why in the hell aren't people talking about this shit? You know, excuse my French. Because it's important. And there's very little discussion. You know, Nikki's pretty much, Nikki Rapana and her daughter live 250 miles north of Anchorage, Alaska, in a very remote part of the world. This time of the year, it's getting down to minus 40 degrees below zero. And they live in a yurt, or at least Nikki does. And they're not necessarily completely off the grid. But, you know, her and her daughter did a lot of the heavy research, the heavy lifting. And I just decided the subject was too important to just, you know, throw it aside. And there needed to be more voice talking about it so that, you know, eventually the smart guys can get into the discussion and sort it out better for all of the rest of us.
So, Lark, just a brief bio, really. How did you get started on this? I mean, you told me you're in your mid-60s now. You were obviously in the Matrix like the rest of us, and then something, where was a spark? What happened?
Well, you know, the only thing I ever wanted to accomplish in life is I wanted to have my own piece of ground and my own house, and I wanted to be independent. And I wanted to leave my own little Garden of Eden, and that was that. And I realized that people today are not independent. They're not free. They don't enjoy liberty. They do not have exercise of free will. And I'm thinking, well, no wonder we're all becoming enslaved. Well, because these are not values that are truly valued.
They think they do, Lark, but they're not.
That's the issue.
And that's the problem. You know, so I did to get them to decipher that, that you think you're free, but actually you're not.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think all of us are in this spider's web. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Leviathan has taken us over. But so anyway, I thought that there might be a way to kind of, I don't know if you've heard of the term panopticon.
No.
Panopticon was, it means all-seeing eye. And there was a man in British history who's called the father of utilitarianism. And he wrote something called Panopticon, which was basically a model prism. But if you were to look up Panopticon, Jeremy Bentham, you would see that it was a model prism for not just for penitentiary houses, as he termed them, but also the schoolhouse, you know, the factory, every single aspect of society. And so that's what we have today, is we have kind of a we kind of live in a digital panoptical age, if you will. And but there was something else that was written, and other people have commented on it, but it's called reversing the panopticon. So in other words, I've tried to unravel the things that have caused us to, as a people, to become enslaved, and see if I can reverse that. And that goes to the mythical tale of the Minotaur and the labyrinth and the string that was secreted in so that the hero could find his way out of the labyrinth and escape from the clutches and living in fear of the Minotaur. But again, look it up, Panopticon, Jeremy Bentham, and reversing the panopticon. And this is why I do what I do, because I know that where there's a will, there's a way. And I don't know if I fully elaborated on that enough to answer your question, but I can just say that I'm sort of like everybody else. I'm nobody special. I used to be, I was a European trained chef. And that was the only thing that mattered to me in life, is I wanted to be a good cook. I thought it was the most noble thing a man could do in a modern age. You know, we no longer live in an agrarian society, and we don't have the same values as we did in the 19th century and older.
Exactly.
And
of course, so when you look what they've done to our food and all of that, I mean, really, you know.
Yeah, it's terrible. In fact, that's why I got out of the industry in 1994.
Yeah.
And by 1997, I, as much as possible, I got off out of the system. And in 2005, I quit banking altogether. So this is how we basically, you know, I advocate for something called counter economics. In other words, you can't be free and independent unless you can actually get away from this spider's web. Yeah. And you have to do it by degrees, unfortunately, because we can't escape at all. I'm working on something that I simply haven't compiled yet as part of a trilogy, and it's going to be simply titled Techno-Slavery. We have to define our terms. You know, slavery never left. It never left us. It's one of man's oldest institutions. Mm-hmm. But a technology, can be language. You know, language is something utile, as Jeremy Bentham would have it, or useful. And so it was a contrivance or an invention of man to facilitate communication. Nothing wrong with that. There's all kinds of tools that we like, things like an anvil, an axe, a lever, a fulcrum, an automobile, electricity, even the personal computer. So these are all tools. They are technologies deemed utile. That's where we get the word utility. But and that's got a lot of application in the field of economics. But counter-economics advocates that you remove yourself from the system as much as possible, and you engage in all human activity deemed useful, which is not harmful to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I still earn a living, but I'm outside of the system.
Yeah, good way to be. Kind of doing that myself in a way, kind of stepping in and stepping out of the system as I choose, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really
best I can do at the moment until I can really find that way of being completely free of it. I think it is extremely difficult, though.
Indeed.
It's nearly impossible. It's nearly impossible.
Well, but we have to have our sight on, you know, what is best for us, right? Because at the end of the day, what we care about is the well-being of for ourselves and the people we care about and our loved ones. Mm-hmm. And you know, I created kind of a blueprint a few years ago that I call the 9 words, and you can find it on the internet at my personal chat that I maintain just for doing shows just like this. And you can find that at J-U-S-T-A, Justa, Numerican, one word, N-U-M-E-R-I-C-A-N, justinamerican.chatango.com. And you'll see those 9 words. But see, everybody or anybody can develop their own blueprint for how it is they want to organize their life. And so we have to set our sights on what's ideal at some point. Because, I mean, I personally don't like being told what to do unless I'm in a position where, you know, I see to a higher authority that knows better. And especially as we get older, you know, more and more we get a little bit more ornery. I mean, I had 100 jobs, before I was 30 years old, Breiser. Mm-hmm. I don't like being told what to do. I got a problem with it. You know, I used to have quite a temper.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've been there before, too. I don't like it.
And my parents were military. I'm sorry?
No, I prefer to mess up myself without anybody telling me that I messed up. You know what I mean? I prefer to acknowledge myself, you know?
Well, that's good. I dropped out of college. I dropped out of college because I didn't want to be indoctrinated or brainwashed, and that's what I was being.
Yeah.
You know, I learned more by shooting pool, you know, and getting hustled out of $300, which was big money back in the 70s, you know?
Oh, yeah.
than I ever learned in a classroom. But, you know, money, language, and tools or technologies are all technologies. They're all tools. Money is a tool. So is language. You know, not too long ago, I was talking about something called core values. Core values is one word. It's published in 2013. Its title is Incitement and Hate Language, Hate Education, and Their Role in Promotion of Violent Conflict and Atrocity Crimes, an Epidemiologic Perspective. It was written by 2 PhDs in Israel, and it was sponsored by the Hebrew University Hadasha School of Public Health in Jerusalem and the Jerusalem Center for Genocide Prevention. Now, this is a perfect example of how they're trying to utilize the language to enact these hate speech laws, like they have in Europe and like they're soon going to have in the States, just like they have in Canada. and in Australia and other places around the world. And this is rather a dangerous development. The Jerusalem Center for Genocide Prevention is JC4GP.org. And at the beginning of this thing was three quotes that I shared recently on a broadcast over at RBN. And it illustrates the value or the importance that these people place on language and how it's manipulated and wielded in their favor or not. And the first thing they cite is Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. And then from Arthur Koestler, who wrote The 13th Tribe and among others, wars are not fought for territory, but for words. Man's deadliest weapon is language. He is susceptible to being hypnotized by slogans as he is to infectious diseases. And where there is an epidemic, the group mind takes over. Mm-hmm. And finally, this is one, this very telling, from Abraham Joshua Heschel. Auschwitz was built not with stones, but words. You like that one?
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. See, this is cryptic language here,
yeah,
in a sense. Mm-hmm. People that are hip will appreciate it and understand it. You know, the unwashed masses are just going to glance right over it, and it will not register as being of import at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you've heard of our Buckminster Fuller, who invented the geodesic dome.
Yeah, he was a kind of libertarian kind of speaker, philosopher type.
And he was called a socialist, too, in his time.
Yeah.
But he said this. He says, to change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. Mm-hmm. And I'm of the opinion that I can't change this system by myself in my lifetime. But I can build a new model. I could hold out that model to other people as an example and affect change that way. In other words, build a new model.
Yeah. The nine words, we'll come back to that because that's your kind of, it's kind of a bit of a solution. You've kind of devised that nine words is a kind of a solution, isn't it, to at least get people thinking.
Yeah, the idea is just to, you know, encourage people to develop a blueprint, something that you can, it could be an exercise for an 8 or 9 year old child.
Yeah.
You know, how do you want to organize your life? What's important?
Exactly. So we'll come back to that, but we'll go back more into the communitarianism again. It is a mouthful, isn't it? Communitarianism. Where did this all start, Mark? Because from my research, it looked like it kind of started in the 30s. Maybe with Aldous Huxley and all that Brave New World, technocracy. But of course, it goes back further.
Yeah. You know, frankly, it goes back into antiquity. But the word itself in English was first coined by a Brit. His name was John Goodwin Barmby. He coined this word in 1841. Now, Barmby also founded something he called a communitarian church. There were several branches and, you know, they died out over time. But he was also the man who accompanied Frederick Engels to France and introduced Frederick Engels to what was known as communisme, or French communism. So, you know, 1841 was a very interesting year in world history. You know, you had Clinton Roosevelt published something called The Science of Government, founded on natural law. You had Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who published an essay called What is Property? In which he declared that ownership of property was tantamount to theft. And of course, as you know, in 1848, we had the publication of the Communist Manifesto. But so Yeah, the word was coined in 1841.
Okay, and so there's a few players there, isn't there? And again, not unusually, they're Jewish. Would I be correct in saying that?
Well, they would be Jewish or sycophants of Jews, or they were interested in the mystery religions. You know, they had a problem with the order established by the Catholic Church, and then the you know, with the splinter of Christendom with the Reformation and so forth and so on. Specifically Freemasons.
Yeah.
And if you look at that that film called The Noahide World Order on YouTube, you'll get a flavor for that.
Okay.
You know, how it is these you know, who are described, you know, you might have heard of the Noahide laws.
Yeah, I don't know.
So according to George H.W. Bush, who recently passed away, well, it was the, you know, it was the foundation to all of Western civilization. I thought that was curious. I never knew that.
No, I didn't either.
But you know what people are calling Western tradition and Western jurisprudence and Western history, it's so much occluded today. I mean, I can remember my shock several years ago to discover that there was a Jewish law professor at Harvard named Harold Berman who taught American law students for 40 years. Mm. And he was a noted Soviet legal expert. So I can't imagine a Jewish legal scholar not being familiar with the Zohar and the Talmud. And, you know, we have to remember who set up the Soviet Union. You know, and who set up the People's Republic of China in 1949. Well, these were Jewish people behind that.
Mm.
You know, it was Jews that were behind the American Civil War. And they controlled both sides. They won that war. And, you know, they were behind the Spanish-American War, the Mexican War before that, then World War One, World War Two. So it's no wonder why they control so many governments today and why their monetary system is in place pretty much all over the world.
Absolutely.
And this is what we're fighting.
Yeah.
You know, a pretty good presentation. I know that you and Graham interviewed E. Michael Jones.
Yeah.
British empiricism versus German idealism. It's a pretty good talk. Gives you some insight into that on YouTube. I just saw it again for about a second or third time recently.
Actually, I hope to have him on again in a couple of weeks. Actually, I will be having him on in a couple of weeks.
Ask him his thoughts about Dorothy Day of Chicago.
Dorothy Day.
D-A-Y, yes. Oh, she founded the...
not Doris Day, the actor. Dorothy.
No. Dorothy Day was a Catholic social worker. She was instrumental in founding something called the Catholic Workers' Party. And actually, there is a movement. There has been a movement for several years now to canonize her in the Catholic Church. So, yeah, ask him about Dorothy Day. I'd be curious as to his answer about that.
I'll take a note of that. Now, who is this guy, Amital Etzioni? He's a major player in communitarianism. Is this guy still alive, or what's his?
He's still alive. He's in his mid-80s. Actually, I think he's 90 now.
Right.
So he is a professor emeritus at George Washington University, which is near the White House in Washington, D.C. Uh-huh. And in 1958, we find him at UC Berkeley in California. He moved on to the Columbia University and then into the Ivy League. But he got his start. He was born Werner Falk, F-A-L-K. And his family emigrated from Germany to Palestine. And then, of course, he became a Jewish terrorist. I think he was with the Haganah. And he studied under a man named Martin Buber, who was a well-regarded philosopher of the time.
Yes.
Martin Buber is B-U-B-E-R. He famously wrote something called I and Thou, translated from the German. And in the United States, he's called the father of communitarianism because, of course, in 1990 or 91, thereabouts, he founded something called the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies. And, you know, nowadays in the States, he's got many acolytes. He's been called a special policy advisor, quote unquote, to every American president since Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's quite influential, especially within academia and really all over the world, because the guy is, I'm sure he's slowing down, but the guy's written, you know, 35 books.
Right.
And of course, he's had lots of people helping him, ghostwriters and the like. But
the interesting thing is that name, Amitai Etzioni, what does that actually mean, Lark?
Tree of Life from Zion.
Tree of Life from Zion.
Yeah.
And if that's not a clue, folks, I don't know what else is. You know?
Yeah, these people are running this country just like they run Great Britain, as you know, and Ireland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Wales and, you know, Northern Ireland. And
yeah, the whole lot, the whole of Europe, everywhere, really. I mean, it's as I say, it's deep.
Are you aware that the British Commonwealth of Nations is the largest voting bloc in the United Nations? Under the Noahide laws, the rabbis consider UN or United Nations to be really meaning Universal Noah.
Ah, right. That's interesting. I didn't know that one either. So
yeah, if I can put out some resources for people who are just broaching this topic.
Uh-huh.
Again, the reason it's important is because it impacts every single aspect of your life,
mm-hmm.
from your right to ownership of property, you know, to your, in fact, you know, under communitarianism, and especially things like the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Humanist Manifesto, and the like, the words property and rights have been completely redefined.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any rights in a communitarian scheme of governance or management, except that rights are accompanied by duties and responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And
the way I look at it, Lark, as a sovereign man, I've got God-given inalienable rights, which cannot be given or taken away.
Yeah, they, I did
they
too.
Can they move in on that? Can they say, well, that's all old hat now, it's our law, or, you know, that's it.
Well, despite their protestations to the contrary, you know, the idea of a monotheistic God and all that, these people,
yeah.
Their conception of God is very different.
It's not why they want God out of the whole equation, because God given rights, you know, and we're born with them.
Most of these people are actually atheists, you know, they're really only hell-bent on control. And, dominance. You know, these people are just ancient slaveholders, you know, and I think Frederick is right when he describes it as really a master slave system.
Yeah.
You know, all evidence points that way. It is a master slave system, and it's really kind of anathema or antithetical to, you know, anything that I always thought about this country and or my place in the world or what have you. You know, by the way, there is such a thing as a difference between unalienable rights and inalienable rights.
Yeah.
Unalienable rights can't be contracted away because they emanate from God.
Yeah.
But inalienable rights can be contracted away. And that's kind of what's happened to all of us. Basically, we have become victims of so-called invisible contracts or contracts of adhesion. In fact, you can still read something on the internet called invisible contract law as legalized slavery. Because frankly, with the superimposition of communitarian law over all nationalist laws, what you have is the imposition of slavery, and it's been made legal. So I look at it like this. It's a system of gangsterism, organized crime made legal, and it actually legalizes slavery. It legalizes sex, child, drug, and human trafficking.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I see here,
they're going to hide it. They're going to hide it, you know, because, of course, you know, you don't want to spook the herd.
No.
Because these people operate as wolves, like as if they were wolves in sheep's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are like the shepherd wielding the hook and the staff.
Yeah.
There can only be one shepherd and everybody else is sheep.
Yeah. And we hear this term thrown around a lot, the common good. It's all in the common good. There's a common communitarianism. Now, I heard this from, I believe it was a judge here. I'm talking about the banking bailouts. Okay? It was all in the common good to bail out the banks and throw people out onto the streets because they couldn't pay their mortgages or whatever. Because it was in the common good because we have to keep the economy going. Isn't this what it's all about? This is what communitarianism is all about. So in this country at the moment, we have a serious eviction crisis where we had this thing called the Celtic Tiger from, say, the late 90s to, say, 98 to 2008. And things were really booming here, loads of jobs, people were buying houses, and suddenly we became from, I would say a poor country, but a relatively poor country in European standards, to becoming one of the richest. And then the plug was pulled, and loads of people lost their jobs, they had huge mortgages, and all of a sudden then the courts came in, the scavengers, the parasites came in, and started a whole process of evictions, which, of course, brings us back to 150 years ago in Ireland when the same kind of thing happened, where history again is repeating itself. That is communitarianism, isn't it? That's what we're seeing, is because the agenda is like private property is a no-no. And what we're hearing now from the government is that we have to bring in affordable social housing, which are basically little shoeboxes that people now can live in. And that's your lot. Do I be correct in saying that?
Now, you're absolutely right, and I did observe what you called the Celtic Tiger over in Ireland. But see, these people toy with us like a cat does with a mouse, and that's because they've been given a grant of monopoly, or they provided it for themselves over issuance of currency and credit, and that includes the money supply. Mm-hmm. And so This is how they ensure that their profits are guaranteed. You know, under communism, if you recall your history, they always targeted what they called the bourgeoisie. You know, in a communist system, you've got your intelligentsia at the top, and you have your nomenclatura, then you have your bourgeoisie, and then your the proletariat. Well, you know, the intelligentsia is your philosopher kings, you know. We can call them the one percenters, if you will. The nomenclatura is your thought leaders and the people that are in the employ of the philosopher kings. And under a socialist or communist system, the bureaucracy or the nomenclatura is expanded so that it can create a large firewall between the already impoverished wage slaves and landless peasants, the proletariat, and the target of their scorn, actually their fear, which is the bourgeoisie or the middle class, those people who feel like they have skin in the game. You know, they own something, a house, a car. They have meaningful work and these types of things. Well, the reason is because it's the bourgeoisie, which is really the only people that can organize and take from the market share of the philosopher kings, the one percenters. In other words, they bring in, when the communists come in, they target the so-called middle class, just like the Bolsheviks targeted the kulaks, which were the large land owners, you know, the farmers and the ranchers in the Ukraine, and starved them out when they collectivized agriculture there. So that's what's happening all around the world. The economy is a new economy, and it largely it's because of this these grin technologies, particularly AI and IT. Mm-hmm. You know, they just assume, these people just as soon have robots run everything, and you know, keep a few people around as sex slaves, and you know, to dress them and you know, clean their toilets and things like that. Whatever the robot couldn't do, you know, this is what they would prefer. But that's what's happening in Ireland, just like it's happening in this country. In this country, we've got over 90 million people of working age who are unemployed.
That's huge. Or,
and, yeah, it's huge. That's nearly a third of the population.
Wow. I didn't think it was that bad, Lark.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, I haven't worked since 1997. So.
Well, I haven't worked since 2011, so there we go.
Yeah,
a few odd jobs here and there, but that's about it, you know.
Well, and then you have to look at the people who are rewarded in this new economy. You know, it's always techies. I mean, they want everybody to have a computer stuck up their ass. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bantu tribesmen in Africa, give them a smartphone, you know, and, you know, everybody mm-hmm. needs to have one because they have to be connected, you know. It's very interesting to note the work of Norbert Wiener, who was at MIT during World War II and immediately following the war. He was interested in something called the theory of cybernetics. And basically, I call it man's marriage with machine. But he wrote a book the year I was born in 1954. Called The Human Use of Human Beings, Cybernetics and Society. And here's the thing to understand too. You know, the Fabian socialists, remember the Fabian Society was chartered by the Crown in 1884. This was a type of socialism that said that they were going to accomplish their world dominion incrementally by degrees. And the way to do that is you want to appeal to the common good and things like utilitarian philosophy. You know, accomplish the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they conscripted as many people as they could to their cause. And remember, Vladimir Lenin said, that you know, he needed all the useful idiots and unwitting dupes as he could find, and that's what these people do. So here we are working for fake money. We think we own our homes. We think we own our cars, and you look at the people that are making bank in this new system. You know, a kid coming right out of college with a degree in computer science that can knock down $80,000 a year. Well, I don't think I ever made that much money my entire, you know, in any 1 year of my life. You know, and so they're quite happy. There's nothing wrong. The world's beautiful, you know. I've got my tiny house. I've got my, you know, 600 square foot apartment. You know, I've got my little Toyota, my Prius or whatever. I've got my job. And you know, that's why I sent you these links about corporations. You know, people forget that a corporation is a collectivist entity.
Yeah, it is.
And you can control people with any kind of a collectivist entity. Mm. You know, I remember in 2011, I was talking about something called syndicalism.
Syndicalism?
Hardly anybody ever heard of the word.
No, but, you know, it's not Rembrandt, more as,
sort of words thrown out there much, but yeah, explain what that is.
Well, it emanates from the medieval European guild system. And if you look it up in encyclopedia, S-Y-N-D-I-C, it comes from the word syndic. And there's a famous Rembrandt painting that's reproduced on Dutch Master cigar boxes to this day, and it's entitled Syndics of the Draper's Guild. Well, the syndics were tradesmen. They were traders of textiles and cloth. You know, they were textile merchants. And, you know, if you look at that painting, the syndics don't look anything like a working man, you know, that actually created the cloth or sewed the cloth or anything else. You know, they were basically schemers. You know, they were interested in feathering their nest and, you know, increasing their market share. And, of course, they were hell-bent on monopoly. Mm-hmm. But syndicalism is defined by trade unionism. In the U.S. history, we have the example of the so-called Wobblies back in the 30s. You know, members of trade unions. And, of course, you have the example in England, where in your part of the world, of the livery companies.
Yeah,
this is how they organize people into collectivist entities. It can be controlled at the top. People give up their exercise of free will, and they cede some of their own autonomy, their personal autonomy, to somebody in charge of a group of which they want to be a member. Well, what people fail to remember, too, is that there were professional trade associations, you know, in the U.S. I mean, you have your worshipful Order of the Bankers, for example. That is a syndicalist organization. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., we have the American Bar Association, the National Governors Association, the Metropolitan Chiefs of Police, the County Sheriffs, the U.S. Conference of Mayors. There are literally thousands of them. Well, syndicalism is a type of socialism.
Right.
And, you know, it's by definition. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, Americans don't realize this, but even libertarianism is considered a type of socialism.
Yeah. Because it's that group mentality, that group, that herd, you know, that, the herd mentality type of thing I'm talking about. Is that what you're saying? Just to bring people
yes.
into the herd and just control them.
You know, there's a story in mythology. It's called the Gordian's Knot. G-O-R-D-I-O-N, I think. Gordian's Knot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing was famous throughout the ancient world. I mean, there was this huge knot, and no one could figure out how to untangle this knot. It was just, you know, it was just a mess. Well, the story goes that Alexander the Great rolled into town one day. And, of course, the townspeople were proud of their, being the location for this thing called the Gordian's Knot. And so they asked Alexander if he would take a look at it. Would he solve the riddle of the Gordian's Knot? Well, Alexander took his sword and sliced it and solved the problem right there. Well, see, this is the problem of the spider's web, and this is the problem of Americans. We have to reverse the panopticon. We have to escape from this matrix, and we can only do it by degrees, as our gut tells us how to accomplish this, because mm-hmm. there can be no exercise of free will, no personal autonomy, no independence, no freedom, no liberty, until we do. Mm-hmm. And this is unfortunately what has befallen all of man in an urban society. You know, back in the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, America was an agrarian society. Well, with the development of technology and the Industrial Revolution, they were flocking to the cities, you know. Farm work didn't seem that appealing to an average child growing up. It was a lonely life for them or something. Mm-hmm. But, there's a lot of factors that caused all of this mess that we're in today. You know, you've heard of smart cities.
Yeah, we'll go into that, Mark. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take a break now, and we'll go into the kind of the real detail of communitarianism, where you can see it in front of you. And cities, smart cities in particular, is a big one. But I'll tell you what we'll do is we're going to play a song. Lark actually mentioned this when I was talking a few days ago. Song by The Clash, you know, the great British punk band, The Clash, and a song called Know Your Rights. Just Google that and just read the lyrics, folks. It's pretty interesting what they say in this song. So we're going to play this tune, folks, about just under 4 minutes. So we'll be back to you after this. Yeah, sorry, welcome back. Yeah, that was The Clash, Know Your Rights. Great words in that song, actually. Lark, you brought it. I remember that song from years back, you know. You were kind of into that stuff too, weren't you?
Yeah, back in the 80s, I really was. For me, it was just fun. It was something new. I mean,
it was fun. It was different. But then I kind of did a bit of research into the whole punk rock thing, and I believe that was all Jewish controlled as well. So there we go.
It was, and yeah. I've looked back myself in hindsight and realized that.
Yeah.
By the way, that particular, I don't know if you saw the Eric Jarman video where they had the WTO protests in Seattle. Did you happen to see that connected to that song?
No, I didn't. No.
Yeah, there's an Eric Jarman. I'll have to send you a link. Maybe I'll put it in the chat room.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I was no longer living in Seattle in 1999. But, hell, the people in Seattle were out on the streets.
Yeah, I remember those protests, all right. I remember the protests, but I don't remember that song being associated with it. So,
Well, so Clash was a British band, you know, after all.
They were. You know, and the whole punk rock movement came out of Britain anyway, so kind of shows, as did the Beatles and the Stones and all of that, too. So you can kind of go into...
People in New York would dispute that.
As you know. I know.
But anyway, so, that's all behind me. It was fun while it lasted, you know. But,
yeah, it was. I mean, I grew up with that, you know, and of course I didn't know any better. It was just kind of crazy music. We just jumped around like a lunatic and, you know, pretended to be a punk. And it was all good fun. It was innocent.
It was all dress up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
In a sense, I mean, I don't know. I lived in San Francisco when they had bands like Bow Wow Wow.
I remember them, yeah.
What was his name? Malcolm McLaren? He's the one
Malcolm
that put that thing
together. Yeah. Sex Pistols, yeah. I think he was Jewish, was he? Or did he have some connection there anyway?
I think he was. I think Eric Jarman was Jewish too. That produced that video for... I don't know. And I got sick after a while, to be honest with you. I mean, anything British... I didn't want anything. I didn't want any part of it after a while.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I like the British people. I love Irish people, you know, but I mean, their ideas and everything else. And the fact that, frankly, I don't think the U.S. of A has ever been separate from Britain.
Well, no, it ever has, really, no.
I mean, the idea of bowing down to the queen and addressing people as a lord or an earl or a duke, I mean, is so abhorrent to most Americans.
Yeah.
We don't know how you people over there even tolerate it.
We don't like that. We don't do that type of stuff at all. And in fact, there's a lot of Brits who don't either. You know what I mean? It's growing. But it's been such an establishment there for such a long time. You know what I mean? And if they only really knew who these people were, you know? But anyway, you go back.
God save the Queen.
As Johnny Rotten sang out loud, you know. But anyway, we'll go back to communitarianism and about smart cities, global cities. I've been looking at things called the Global Parliament of Mayors, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which is all about global cities, city managers, all this type of stuff. This is the stuff we're seeing now, okay? And it's been implemented right under our noses. There seems to be a thing where cities or a mayor will say, well, we're very concerned about climate change, so we're going to push this agenda forward. So there's just an example. And other cities are saying, well, we're going to do that too. And suddenly the other politicians, even though we know they're all corrupt and in on the whole thing, are kind of being sidelined. So where do you see this is going with regards to, say, national governments? Are they being sidelined, and are we moving into a city-state type of scenario around the world where you have, you know, if you're part of that city, you're part of that community, so you believe in all this type of stuff like climate change, mass immigration, cultural Marxism, you know, the whole gay, transgender nonsense, all of that stuff. Where do you see this going yourself? This seems to be the plan from what I can see.
Well, remember, under communitarianism, unlike communism, they don't plan on getting rid of what's called capitalism today. I see it like this. I see the nation state being supplanted by the globalized market state. And in turn, I see the rise of the regionalized city-state. Mm-hmm. So remember, a city-state was something indicative of a democracy. Remember ancient Greece.
Yeah.
Athens, Sparta, Corinth, etc.
And Rome.
Then you,
and Rome to a point?
Well, Rome gave rise to, of course, the Republic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of the ideas were taken from the writings of Plato. Res publica. But, you know, it eventually was corrupted. You know, it was the Roman Republic that gave rise to the corporation and also the trade unions, for instance.
Hmm.
So just look it up. History of corporations.
Hmm.
And you can see all that. Today, I don't think anybody really knows the difference between democracy and a republic. There's really not much difference. Some have observed that, frankly, democracy is just a euphemism for world communism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a buzzword.
What would your definition of a republic be?
Well, it was the way that I fancied it was that a Republican living in a Republican form of government, that would be the individual, was one who was concerned about private affairs.
Yeah.
And everything else belonged properly, more properly, within the public arena.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a proper republic, at least as it was, we thought it was styled in America, was that we would have a limited form of government. And there would be a check and balance, you know, that was drawn from Charles de Montesquieu and his separation of powers principle. And in other words, the government would be small. This would allow for the maximum amount of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people would be concerned about their private affairs more so than their public affairs. Their interactions in the public arena would be done through their elected representatives. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the way the system has broken down, that frankly, I don't think there's anybody that's connected to what we formerly called government. Remember, government is mind control. The word today is governance, which mm-hmm. is simply management or scientific, quote unquote, management. Again, nation states are going bye-bye. They're going by the wayside.
Yeah.
And we can see it because, you know, we've got the border issues, you know, here in the States, particularly at our southern border. And then we've got all these free trade agreements, which confer terrific powers to these multinational corporations, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. And the idea is to protect their trade at the expense of the individual small independent business people, for instance. So I don't think that any of these people that from the mayor to the city council to the governor, I don't think they represent me at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said famously, the courageous individual, the first step of the courageous individual is not to take part in the lie. Now, substitute the word we. Yeah. The first step of the courageous individual is not to take part in the we.
Yeah.
One word of truth outweighs the world. And in the 1920s, there was a dystopian novel, quite influential, entitled just that, W-E-We. And it was written by a Russian professional man. His name was Evgeny Zamyatin. And the book was first published in New York, but it describes one of these smart cities of the future. You can read the plot summary. Just look up we in the encyclopedia. And of course, Yevgeny Zamyatin, his last name is spelled Z as in zebra, A-M-Y-A-T-I-N. Well, this is what where the world is headed, because it's, you know, people that are living in a beehive are much more easily controlled if they're in mass. They want to throw people off the rural parts of the land. They want to, you know, have this new kind of scientific agriculture, and, you know, they're going to rewild the planet and all this other kind of nonsense. And we just can't fall prey to these things. You know, we have to basically look to what we want out of this human experience. You know, what do we want out of our lives? And we have to toe the line. Most of us are easily led. We go along to get along. I was no exception. I was told that the whole purpose of going to college was so you can go out and get a good job.
Yep.
I didn't believe that for a minute. I mean, I wanted to learn something. I was curious about the world. I was young. I did not want to be led around by my little nosy. And I always had questions. I never stopped asking questions. And therefore, you know, in a group setting like a classroom, that was problematic. Because if I was actually engaged in the discussion and I found it interesting, I had questions. I mean, I had the same problem in high school. You know, we're talking about history. I always had questions. You know, the teacher can't teach outside of the curriculum. You know, the public education system has always been socialist in nature. You know, it's about socializing or indoctrinating the workers of the society. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, it's getting people into that groupthink mentality where so mass immigration is great. It'll be a boon to our economy, right? If you go against that or you even question it, you're a racist. If you question the so-called Holocaust, you're an anti-Semite. If you question feminism, you're a misogynist. And on it goes. So it's kind of like get everyone into thinking the same, conform, don't ask questions. Because if you do, you will be shunned or else even sent to the gulag in the worst case scenario, which could even happen, you know. Isn't that what all this is about, is to get everyone on the same, just thinking the same, not questioning, just going, just believing everything that the so-called authorities tell you, and that's it.
Well, and with the specter of techno-slavery upon us, I mean, we're seeing precisely what Aldous Huxley was alluding to in 1962 at UC Berkeley. He talked about the ultimate revolution, that being that man would learn to love and embrace his slavery.
Yes.
He just couldn't imagine not being a slave, because being a slave is just too much damn fun.
Yeah. So, right, I have to wonder, how did these people know that this was going to happen way back then? That intrigues me a bit. How did they... Obviously, they had a plan to put this down, as this is a great way to control society. So they implemented it, what, just slowly but surely, just threw in a few things here and there. They had the money, I suppose, behind them to be able to do it. And just direct people in certain ways. Is that it? Or because well, it just baffles me.
I just
me.
Think we have we just have to recognize that things like piracy and slavery has never left us. It's always been with us.
Yeah. So they just...
It's always...
It was just a continuation, really. It was just a continuation of everything.
Right.
But how did they know, though, that we're going to have this technology that we have now? Did they have it? Did they know about it back then? Did they know that we're going to have smartphones that we could connect instantly with people?
Well, I mean, I don't know about that. I'm quite sure there was vision. There's always been visionaries in a society. I'll point something else out to you that, you know, I alluded, I referenced earlier this so-called separation of powers principle. And this same guy, he was a jurist, you know, he was a legal practitioner, Charles de Montesquieu of France. He also wrote something called The Spirit of Law, The Spirit of Law. Mm-hmm. And, but there was another man in English history, and his name was Bernard de Mandeville. Now, Bernard de Mandeville was an economist. He came up with what he championed something called the division of labor theory. So you can control people if you can isolate them and separate them from a larger group. In other words, compartmentalize them. This is what corporations do. And that's why, you know, in capitalism, you have your own caste system, just like the communists have their caste system. And like the Brahmins of ancient India had their caste system. You know, in a capitalist caste system, you have the shareholders. In communitarian parlance, they're known as stakeholders, also known as stockholders. Well, then you have your board of directors, you have your management class, and you have your worker or laboring class. And they generally, by and large, keep these groups separate from each other. They're compartmentalized. And if you can imagine in very large corporations, you know, it's very much like the military. That's why they have a martial rule system. I mean, they do not brook dissent. You know, it's like you have a chain of command and you take orders and this is just the way it is. Well, your listeners might find it interesting to learn about this thing called the division of labor theory and Bernard de Mandeville, because he wrote a rather infamous poem, which was quite notorious in his time. It was called The Fable of the Bees.
Of the Bees.
The Fable of the Bees. And we have to remember that, you know, Adam Weishaupt, you know, working in tandem with the Rothschild, to create the so-called Bavarian Order of the Illuminati, which was announced, I think, on May Day, May 1st, 1776. He thought to call the Order of the Illuminati at once the Order of the Bees, and at other times he called it the Order of the Perfectibalist.
Say that again?
Perfectibalist.
Perfectibalist. Okay.
It's like the word perfect, P-E-R-F-E-C-T, I-B-I-L-I-S-T-S, the perfectibalist. Okay. There's actually a book, you can find a book that's on the internet about that. It's probably a pretty good book. I haven't read it. But he likened the ideal society to a beehive. In other words, you had your queen bee, you had the queen's court, her retinue, and the only people allowed the queen were female worker bees. And the only males which were allowed in were male drones. Yeah. And it was only one male drone, and his duty was to impregnate the queen, upon which he was promptly killed.
Yes.
Outside of the hive, you had your worker bees and you had your drones. And so this was a caste system. So a lot of people thought this way down through history. They looked at a honeybee hive and they thought, what a wonderful orderly system. These people, these bees, they just go, go, go. They work, work, work. They just don't stop till they die. And here at the center of it all is the queen, whose only job is to create more bees. as the rest of them are dying off.
Yeah.
Well, that's why he wanted to call it the Order of the Bees. And, you know, it's very interesting that the transhumanist, according to the likes of Joseph P. Farrell and Scott DeHart in their book called Transhumanism, A New Grimoire of Alchemical Agendas, the transhumanists have their caste system too. And, you know, from memory off the top, it's androgynous man is at the top. This is a person that is neither male or female, but neither event, they do not breed. And see, underneath them, you have, you have your plant man or vegetable man. Right. And between the plant man or vegetable man and the androgynous man, you have your mineral man. And this is presumably a man who's been fitted with a silicon chip.
Ah.
In other words, he's controlled by outside agency.
Yes.
So again, ascending to descending, it's the androgynous man, then mineral man, then vegetable or plant man, and finally animal man. Mm. Now, here's the way it works. Again, mineral man is controlled by outside agency, presumably with the silicon chip. So he's controlled. Then below him, you have vegetable man. Well, you know, vegetable man is like a cow or a sheep that chews its cud, that feeds on grass. You know, they're generally quite docile anyway. And so they don't pose a threat to the order of things. But then you have the animal man, and animal man is considered violent and irrational. And so this is the man that must be targeted and eliminated if you want to have a perfect controlled society. And the only animal man that you want to keep around would be for breeding purposes. Otherwise, you want to eliminate them. And see, this is the new transhumanist agenda. So they don't want anybody making waves. They don't want anybody crossing swords with the powers that be. They want people just to go along, to get along, shut up and do what you're told. Mm. And that's the new order of things in a transhumanist society.
Yeah. So all of this is linked, this technocracy. I know there's a guy called Patrick Woods. He talks a lot about technocracy. It was all, this is the main agenda of the Trilateral Commission. And again, it's about everything that you just said there. And Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030, sustainable development, it's all linked, isn't it? Everything.
Yeah, you know, I've tried to tell people over the years, because I had to learn this myself and to pass it along. You know, the language of sustainable development was codified in 1987 with what was called the Brundtland Report, and it was entitled Our Common Future. Now, Gro Brundtland, G-R-O-S, is a woman, former president of Norway, former Secretary General of the World Health Organization attached to the United Nations, and she was a vice president of the Socialist Internationale. In 1992, at Rio de Janeiro, the 130 or 170 nations around the world at an event that was organized by Mikhail Gorbachev and Maurice Strong of Canada, they adopted something called Earth Charter. Mm-hmm. And with the adoption of Earth Charter in 1992 during the Clinton administration, they had something, they had a policy called reinventing government. Mm-hmm. And with reinventing government, they privatized every single aspect of what was formerly thought by the American people to be long in the public domain. So everything has been privatized today. The office of the White House, of the presidency, has been privatized. It's a corporation. Mm-hmm. The office of your mayor in your town is a corporation. And these people have to sign non-compete, non-disclosure agreements, which means that they lawfully have every right to lie to their constituents, because they are not permitted to reveal the inner workings of what goes on behind closed doors. because they're said to be protecting trade secrets, like any corporation wants to protect trade secrets, their trademarks and patents and copyrights and so forth. So that's the reality of this. I mean, we don't have representative government anymore. I mean, do you think anybody that's in public office, quote unquote, in Ireland today represents your interest?
No.
I mean, absolutely there isn't anybody around. I mean, I consider that I'm surrounded by zombies and criminals. A zombie is a person who is not entirely in possession of his or her own mind. And I actually think of a zombie sort of like I do a rabid animal. You know, when you encounter a rabid dog or a wild animal in nature, I mean, what are your first thoughts? You either want to get the hell out of there or you're going to do whatever you have to protect yourself. You're going to kill it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they're not of, I mean, they're out of their minds. Yeah. Well, and a criminal is someone who is either compliant, complacent, or complicit with the organized crime, the system of gangsterism, organized crime made legal that we live in. So, I mean, are these people in their right mind? No, I don't think so either. So this is the reality of the world you live in. You're surrounded by zombies and criminals. You're behind enemy lines, which means you must be guided accordingly. And that's a sad realization. You know, with this, and I'm stop me if anytime you want, because I'm rambling just a bit you know, there's a phenomenon that a woman named Linda Stone, lindastone.net, has identified as continuous partial attention. Okay. Now, we consume more media, especially electronic media, than any other time in human history today. Do we see how that we may be suffering from continuous partial attention that never ends? Mm-hmm. I mean, I could say that, you know, and that's why it's important to develop a plan for how you want to go forward. And I don't claim to have all the answers. I don't want to have all the answers because, you know, I have kind of a live and let live, non-aggression, libertarian style philosophy about the way I live my life. I'm not qualified to tell you how to live your life. You know,
what's your take on this whole, on anarchism, you know, the types of Larkin Rose and all these people, what's your take on them? I mean, they do come out with some very interesting things. But,
they do.
But they there's do. Something there's something amiss, though.
Well, that's the absence of government altogether.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you're basically going down kind of a, what's the word? It's a dangerous path to take that road.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem, you know, I mean...
Well, it hasn't really been tried before. I mean, they make a good argument that we all kind of, we live a kind of anarchy kind of lifestyle because we make our own decisions in life, just the general basic day-to-day stuff, which is true. The government don't intrude on that too much, you know. But in the general things, I can't see how a community of people like a town, a village or something can come together and all they need is this, what they call a non-aggression principle. And everything will be fine. You're going to have disagreements. So who's going to?
Well, but that doesn't mean a system of anarchy has to displace law. You see what I'm saying? We have to not conflate the terms. You know, interestingly enough, Peter Thiel, who was one of the angel investors with what became known as Facebook. You know, he describes himself as an anarcho-syndicalist. Mm-hmm. You know, Emma Goldman described herself as a anarchist.
Yeah, there's a lot of Jews involved in anarchy too. You know,
that's right, like Larkin Rose. So
yeah. What's the other guy? Murray Rothbard is another guy. Yeah.
Yeah, well, because I'm not Jewish, I'm generally... because they are the dominant group in the world today, I'm generally mistrustful of their motives. You know, and it's not like I dislike Jewish people. That's not true at all. It's just that I'm mistrustful of their motives because of the way they were raised. I mean, I didn't attend a yeshiva.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and I was never told.
Well, Lark, I don't know any Jews. Yeah, I there's very few of them here in Ireland, right? There's only maybe a couple of thousand. So I've never had any immediate contact with them, so I don't know what they're like. But I do see the overall bigger agenda, and I'd like to be able to point that out and question it without being, you know, the usual anti-Semite type of nonsense that they put up with, you know. And when you question them on it, on a lot of different issues, they just resort to that. They cannot kind of come back with a reasonable, rational debate. And that's the issue I have. Like, you know, I mean, if they're saying, okay, the Holocaust happened, fine. Give me your side of the story and tell me here and show me the evidence, because this is my evidence and from what I have, and it just doesn't seem to add up, you know?
Well, you know, you might want to look at something called general semantics and Holocaust denial. You know, the way that they're employing word definitions to the same words that you're using are not the same.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, I think you can attack ideas, but to attack people, and especially with a broad brush, I don't think is very much a winning formula. And actually, I'm looking for, you know, people I care about, myself, and, you know, the future generations, to come up with a winning formula that works. Mm-hmm. I appreciate people that call themselves white nationalists, mm-hmm. and people who will attack the Jews, mm-hmm. for instance, you know, but it's not really my style to do that, because I frankly think the issues are much bigger than that. You know, it's all, you know, when we talk about communitarian law, it's wrapped up with contract law and commercial law today. So, you know, how we choose to ally ourselves with other people and in what fashion, you know, it very much defines who we become, what we are. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think, frankly, Christian Zionists are a bigger problem by far than the Jews.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
For instance, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why I don't think it's a winning argument. I think it's okay to point out that, you know, that it's a, you know, that it's Jewish people and Jewish companies, mm-hmm. dynastic, wealthy families that control the money. Mm-hmm. I mean, that needs to be, you know, everybody should know about that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think people realize how much they control the media, including the internet and, you know, Wall Street, J Street, mm-hmm. Hollywood, and real estate. Mm-hmm. These people are quite ethnocentric. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got to hand it to them. You know, I mean, they're in control and they want to stay in control for whatever reason, you know, and we've allowed it to happen. It didn't happen just on our watch. It happened on our parents, our grandparents, and our great-grandparents' watch.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. Okay, let's go back to the nine words. You sent me this link, which is quite interesting, and it's a way, as you say, to free yourself from, as you say yourself, slave speak and communitarianism code speak, divided into three groupings of three words each. So we'll start off with the three C's: compliant, complacent, complicit. Okay, we got about 20 minutes, Lark. Let's go through this.
Well, you know, the three C's are easy. It has everything to do with the matrix. And remember, this is an ideal. This is something you intellectualize. It's a blueprint. It's a goal. If you mm-hmm. care about things like independence, personal autonomy, exercise of free will, freedom, and liberty. Mm-hmm. I mean, if these ideas are to remain alive in our hearts and minds, we have to ask ourselves, well, let's decide how important they are or not. And in my view today, because we live in a system of organized crime made legal, I just say that you cannot be compliant with it. You cannot be complicit. And remember that word complacent is spelled two different ways with two different meanings. The way I mean it is C-O-M-P-L-A-I-S-A-N-T or C-E.
Yeah, so what's the difference between C-O-M-P-L-A-C-E-N-T?
Well, complacent, C-E-N-T, yeah. In the usual sense, is intellectual lethargy. laziness.
Laziness, okay.
Okay.
Complacence
in the other spelling and the other meaning means that you are a very agreeable. You're the go along to get along type.
Yeah, that's spelled C-L-O-M-P-A-I-S-A-N-T.
C-O-M-P-L-A-I-S-A-N-T, indeed.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're the go along to get along. I mean, you know, I don't want to make waves and I don't need any, no tension, no strife here today. You know,
most people are like that. Like most people are like that. They fall into that, don't they?
I tend to be that way myself.
Do my job, feed the family, all that type of stuff. Yeah.
Well, I would go to work for, in my career, back when I had a career before 1994, I mean, I'd go to work for the Sheraton Corporation, and I knew very well how to act within a corporate structure. Mm-hmm. I knew all the games. I knew the rules of the road and all that other stuff. And I could do well in that mm-hmm. setting. Yeah. The problem is it bothered me after a while. And especially if I had to deal with difficult personalities and I had to deal with internal politics and all that. See, the only thing I cared about was culinary art.
Okay.
And I wanted to please people. That's the only reason I even went into that business. And I believe things like, Jean Anthelme Briat Savarin. He's a famous French gastronome. If you will, he was a food critic and the like. It was called The Physiology of Taste. And he basically said, you tell me what you eat and I'll tell you who you are. And this is what I cared about. I felt like the whole problem of the world was that people just had crappy diets.
Yeah.
That's the way I was in my 20s and 30s. And so anybody that didn't want to let me produce art and create something beautiful to please people, they were impediments. They were standing in my way. But, that's just a mild form, you know. But when you go along with, when you move into a suburban neighborhood, you know, you're forced to become a member of a homeowners association. Well, that's a communitarian construct.
Right.
You know,
neighborhood watch. That's a communitarian construct.
Well, see.
Really?
Yeah, your local cop on the beat doesn't even know that he's enforcing communitarian laws. I mean, I've discovered it in my own neck of the woods.
Yeah.
I recounted the story a couple times of recent they have these meet and greets, you know, like at the local espresso shop or something. Mm-hmm. And the cops get together and, they're going to teach the homeowners and the people in the neighborhood, the citizenry, how to be good watchdogs for the cops.
Yeah,
so they can become a part of a Stasi like organization, they have in East Germany.
Yeah,
and everybody thinks, oh yeah, I want to back the boys in blue, you know, and I want the neighborhood safe, and boy, I don't want these bad guys coming to my neighborhood, and so yeah, what do we got to do, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I went to a couple of these things, and in these kind of informal settings. The police officers, you know, they have a sense that, well, these are people that actually like us, so we can let our hair down a little bit. And they gladly give over their business cards with their badge numbers and so forth. Well, I met this one who had a card too, but instead of a badge number, it said PhD. He happened to be the assistant chief of police. And I brought up the issue of communitarian law in about a 30-minute casual conversation with the man standing outside with a cup of coffee in our hands, and he did not bat an eye. He knew all about it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You're not an American, but, we had Gruff the Crime Dog back in the 80s. You know, my dad was a neighborhood watch captain.
Okay.
He got out there with his little .22 and actually patrolled the neighborhood for free. At 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, because the guy was a workaholic and he owned his own business and he oftentimes got home late and he just felt honor bound. He was retired from the U.S. Air Force to actually patrol the neighborhood. And he was going to report the bad guys to the police. Yeah. And it just grew from that. That was back in the 80s.
And then if he could catch a good guy, everyone would hear about him and say, hey, he's a great guy. He's standing up for us. And isn't this wonderful? So everyone gets on board. That's what it's all about.
Well, with communitarian law, you have a lot of victimless crimes, you know, for which you can be fined or imprisoned. And that's very different from common law, because there always has to be property damage.
That's right.
Thing about it is how do we define this word property? Well, you know, and how do we define this word economy? Mm-hmm. You know, making a segue, you know, but still part of the nine words that we were talking about. Economy is the ergonomic, efficient management of one's own household. And so what is your household? Well, first and foremost, I like to say it's that which resides inside your own skin. You know,
yeah,
that's your property. This is my property.
Uh-huh.
You see,
yeah,
and what the communitarians seek to do is that they want to be the owners of your property, which is you. And that includes what comes out of your mind, what comes out of your head, what comes out of your mouth.
Yeah. Interesting.
Anyway, so that's what you want to do is you start with the three C's and avoid them.
Yeah,
I
know. We'll move on. We can go about 5 minutes after. There's not a problem there. Just want to get this out for people just so they can look at these words. I'll send a link into the chat so people can have a look. So the next three words, counter economics, and then in brackets, all peaceful human action which is forbidden by the state. Then autarky. I've never heard this word before. It says implied self-ownership, self-rule. And then autarky, but spelled differently, AUTARKY, in brackets, self-sufficiency. So can you explain them, you know, as briefly as you can, but just give us a kind of an outline of what you mean by that.
Sure. Counter-economics was developed by Samuel Edward Conklin III. And he was a Jewish theoretician. And I would advise the listener just look it up. Counter-economics. They describe a black market, a red market, you know, and so forth. There's specific language to it, but it's not complicated at all. Uh-huh. And I actually like the idea of engaging in all human action, which is forbidden by the state, because I don't want anything to do with the capital S-T-A-T-E state. No. I want as little interaction with government in the state as possible, because frankly, I don't want to get into this. I don't want to be trapped by the spider's web. So I consider the state or the government and anybody attached to it to be that spider. And I mean, I'm just a little insect, and spiders are there to eat me, and I don't want anything to do with them. You know?
Yeah.
So that's my attitude about that. So I would advise the listeners just to read that. The other two are just words, you know, autarky, AUTARCHY, or autarkism. Uh-huh. It presumes that you are self-governing. In other words, you are a person who wishes to take responsibility for managing your own affairs. It's that simple. And you can read about that too. And then finally, the other spelling of autarky with a K is something that I learned from Michelle Renouf. She said it was how the National Socialist economic miracle was accomplished.
Uh-huh.
And I became fascinated by it because it's about self-reliance, self-sufficiency. It's about having a system of trade and barter that always is in place. Whether money goes away tomorrow or not, we always, folks, have trade and barter.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's never left us.
Oh.
You know, this money is just a tool of our enslavement. It is the instrument of our enslavement.
I know.
And when we're talking about we, especially in the nation state and the governments and so forth, because these Jewish bankers have taken control, you know, with their, in the States, this 100-plus-year Ponzi scheme.
Exactly. So whether it's paper or whether it's digital, it's just a big Ponzi scheme, as you said. And do you think that's kind of going to come to an end and we're going to move into a cashless-type society or something like that?
I think they'd like to move us towards that, but I don't think it's going to happen. Remember, they've adopted the Fabian model for world dominion. You know, they're going to do things as they can, little by little, because it's worked swimmingly for them so far. Why would they change course or tactics?
I know.
Yeah, it'd be interesting for the listeners to learn about how this this word Fabian Society came into be, you know, yeah. And read a little bit about it. But, you know, they adopted it from a military strategy, you know, adopted by a Roman consul who finally was able to defeat Carthage and Hannibal during the Punic Wars. But where are we now? I'm not looking at my notes. So we
We got down to the last three. Law, counteract, but you've got some brackets there. So you got law and then C-O-U-N, I think. Or C-O-U, brackets, C-O-U, and bracket I-N-T, E in brackets, R in brackets, act, interact.
And then
well-beingness and econa me, as in M-E. So, okay.
Explain. There you have it.
Okay.
Okay, I can explain it. And remember, this is only my blueprint. It's a suggestion for anybody else. You know, take it. It's yours, you know, if you like it, you know. But I've decided law was so complicated. You know, you've got scientific law. You've got spiritual law. You've got universal law. You've got common law, contract law, constitutional law, maritime law, admiralty law. And, you know, there must be a couple hundred at least different types of law. I decided it was so damn complicated that I had to boil it down to one word that made sense to me. And so I did. I boiled it down to one word. Awesome. And the word is counteract.
Counteract.
Now, those brackets and parentheses symbols are really just to point out, because I tell you where I actually spell that out, you know, explain it. There's a link provided there. Basically, how many words can you get out of that one word counteract that makes sense to you? Well, you have the word con, count, counter, act, react, contact, and contract. Just for starters. Well, see, all of life is one of contract or contact. You know, you cannot be a psychophysical being and live in this plane of existence, except that you have contact with air, which you need to breathe, and you need water. And you need nourishment of food, and you need presumably shelter from the storm. I mean, these are the basics of life. And so it's a law of the universe or nature that we must have established contact. And contract is how we negotiate. A contract is a relationship between ourselves, within and without, every being. Our neighbors, our friends, people we do business with.
Yeah. We do it all the time.
So, that's right.
If I say to you, Lark, I'm going to meet you on the street there tomorrow at noon, that's a contract.
That's exactly right. And so it's just a fact of life. And so it's reality. And I happen to like reality better than this BS that's not reality.
Yeah.
That's being erected, being imposed upon us, if you will.
Yeah.
And so remember that for whatever it's worth, this listening, a contract is always a relationship. And I have a link to an article called Chinese Contract, which is rather interesting to read just if you want to learn more about contracts.
Okay.
And you might want to look up something too called the elements of essential contract.
The seven elements of contract law. Yeah, I've looked into that.
Yeah. And so to me, a contract is either valid or invalid. It's honorable or dishonorable. It's private or public.
Yeah.
Okay. In all cases, I prefer valid, honorable, private contracts.
Uh-huh. Yes, indeed. And then you go on about well-beingness. That's obviously health, which is a huge one, really, because we're being attacked at every angle, health-wise, between vaccines, fluoride, GMOs, all that kind of stuff. Is that what you're talking about there?
Well, yes, and really, it's integral. I mean, it's the most important thing about your life is your personal well-being, because that's what we all care about. Now, one time a man was considered wealthy if he had access or owned a well.
Yeah. Oh, where the word wealthy came from, maybe.
Think so. Yes.
Yeah. Probably.
So when you talk about you know, we're also at wealth. We're talking about health. Mm-hmm. We're talking about wellness. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about other words like serenity and peace. And, you know, there are many words attached. You know, there's happiness attached to this word called well-being. And I put the word, I called it well-beingness because it's not actually a word. It's my own word. Because when I see N-E-S-S, it's like happiness or, you know, loveliness or whatever, you know, but it means a condition or the condition of well-being.
Yeah.
That's how I styled it that way, because I wanted to define it my way.
Yeah.
And when we talk about that, you know, you have to talk about things which are needful or of necessity and things which are born of want or of desire. And, you know, you always want to address needful and necessary things first and things born merely of desire second. Mm-hmm. In other words, you want to be able to, you know, if you've got your, you know, daily honeydew list or your activities or your, you know, your plan of action for the day, you know, you always want to keep in mind or address first and foremost what is of necessity to, so that you can maintain your independence, your well-being. Your health, etc.
That's it. So I always say, you know the old saying, your health is your wealth. If you're not healthy in this time and age that we're living in, you can't do anything. And you're reliant on a system that is going to feed you drugs and God knows what to kill you off at some point. So you know, health is hugely important.
Yes, and if we're a rational creature, we're always having to make choices. It happens constantly. It's never ending. We're always making choices. And if we want to continue to make choices that are free of somebody else's definitions and somebody else's rules, then we need to stick to this blueprint.
Yeah.
You know? In other words, we have to weigh the better with the best, the good with the bad, et cetera, et cetera. We're making choices.
Dude.
And I guess that final word, what is that? Economy.
Economy. E-C-O-N-O and then dash M-E.
Well, the reason I spelled it that way, because again, it's not in the dictionary.
Oh.
We defined economy as the ergonomic and efficient management of one's own household. So, you know, old cookbooks from the 18th and 19th century always talked about cookery as a branch of economy. Mm-hmm. Household management was considered very important, especially to women, but to men as well, because see, they were entrusted with the management of their household, you know, from which they raised their children and so forth and so on. So economy is not economics. Anything having to do with economics and what they teach you at a university, to me, is just so much blather.
It's complete nonsense,
and I don't listen to any of it. It means nothing to me. I don't give a damn.
No.
In fact, there's an article that anyone can read online. It's called How the Federal Reserve Bought the Economics Profession. So anybody that styles himself as an economist and somebody important, an expert or whatever, I dismiss them out of hand. Yeah. Because it has nothing to do with the economy. And the other thing to remind everyone, too, is this word capital has nothing to do with capitalism at the end of the day.
Oh.
You have to go back and look at what is capital. But what is interesting is in your encyclopedias today, they have the communist and the capitalist definitions for capital.
Capital to me was your energy that you put out to create something. That's capital, isn't it?
It is, but it's other things too. It's a resource.
Yeah.
You know, and the communitarians, just like the communist and the capitalist, the uber rich super capitalist, if you will.
But they don't create anything though, Lark. That's the thing.
No, they're like John D. Rockefeller. Own nothing, control everything.
Yeah. Oh.
You know, John D. Rockefeller also said competition is a sin. Well, whatever did he mean? Well, as long as he could have the monopoly and he could control it. And of course, they put all their wealth and trusts and foundations and stuff to basically shield their assets and preserve their wealth. And, you know, that could be said, well, we don't own anything because we made the rules and, you know, and but yeah, we control everything.
Yeah.
So that word economy is important.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw a story today, a small town in Ireland where there was this beautiful kind of greengrocer shop, okay, that sold all his great vegetables, locally grown vegetables, a lot of organic and all that.
Uh-huh.
It's been in existence for about 70 years or something in the family. It was a place where people would come and meet and chat and everything and, you know, sit down, even have a cup of tea or whatever, and it was... And they had to close it down because the environmental people came in and said, oh, this is not right. You have to change the floors, the walls, and the ceiling, you know, basically rebuild the whole damn thing. And, of course, they had to close it down because they couldn't afford to do that. So there is an institution of a proper community where people came together, discussed things, had a laugh, you know, find out the gossip of what's going on. Now gone. And that is just a sign of where we're going, isn't it? Because you cannot set up your own little business like that. Something that's kind of unique and different. We have to have this kind of consumerist, big stores, the big corporations moving in, where you go in and you buy crap food. And you can't go to your local little store anymore and meet up with people. That's it, isn't that? That's communitarianism, really, in a nutshell, isn't it? It's kind of that's where we're going. To close all those.
Well, you know, there was a document called Target 2000. Here we are, 2019. Mm-hmm. Target 2000. The communitarian regulatory system is well established today. We live under the authority of unelected bureaucrats. And all of these bureaucrats seek what they term a global harmonization of norms under the supremacy of communitarian law. And in America, the late Justice Antonin Scalia famously said, the Constitution is dead, dead, dead.
Wow.
So we should be positive about our prospects for the future, but it begins with identifying what the problem is.
So just to finish up now, we're coming to the end of the show. Just to finish up, what's your take? We're definitely going to have you on again, Lark, to talk more into this because we've only scratched the surface on this.
Well,
just to finish
that's
up,
wonderful,
just to finish up yourself, how can we need to become aware of all of this, right? I mean, we're seeing it under our noses. It's right there. But we need to piece it all together and realize what's going on. That this is, folks, this is actually a Jewish conspiracy, right? When people say that it's not, that doesn't exist, it's there because the people behind communitarianism are, for the most part, Jewish, okay? It's there. The facts are there. So we need to understand this problem. Sorry, Lark, go ahead, yeah?
I would call it a... I don't know. I would call it it's the problem is one of contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have so many invisible contracts and so many contracts of adhesion today. We're just unfamiliar with the lay of the land. And we're operating in ignorance of these things. Yeah. I would say it's as much a Masonic conspiracy as a Jewish conspiracy.
Yeah.
But, you know, because it impacts, you know, upon every field of human endeavor.
Yeah.
There's a lot of places to lay the blame. I like to look at it this way. You know, every time that you point the blame at some group or someone or something as being the source of your angst, your problems, always remember there's three fingers pointing right back at you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm aware of that. Absolutely.
That's why we have to look at it from that perspective. I don't think we're going to win friends and influence people if we... I mean, let's face it,
yeah.
We've got a lot of people that are just not awake, quote unquote. And so why would we want to go about just alienate these people? You know, yeah. We're not going to win any converts to our cause, and we can't win as a collective. We yeah. can't change the path that we're on unless we can win converts to our cause. And really, it's all about freedom and liberty and, you know, be able to have an authentic human experience, you know, without all these constraints. Remember, communitarianism, like socialism, is a system of arrested development. It's a system which seeks to thwart your human potential. Churchill used those words.
Yeah.
Arrested development. Arrested development. This is, we don't want, you know, I mean, I'm tired of all this rigged game BS. I'm sure you are too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's a rigged game. So what we want to seek to do is put our heads together and work with work outside of their system. We need to create our own model and work our game, and to hell with their game.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And we can do that. There's a lot of smart people that listen to your show and
that's why I do this, Lark, to get the word out to people at least. And I do it when I go out and talk to other people. I mean, even though they're not as awake, but I at least get them to question things a little bit. And, you know, I was talking to people, I was talking to people about this stuff about 3 or 4 years ago. And now they're coming up to me and saying, you know, you were right about this, to begin to see it. It took them a few years to get it. But that's fine. I don't care how long it takes, as long as we get it out there and keep pushing, you know.
Well, a lot of us in our lives are seeking what's called the truth.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine who passed away, his name is William Blair. I have a whole series at my old blog called The Sum of All Things, parts 1 through 5. Okay. And that's at larkintexas.blogspot.com. But the fuller quote is, the sum of all things is the truth. We have to keep that in mind, the sum of all things, you know, and the greatest lie of them all, let's remember, is the lie of omission.
Yeah, I agree. Indeed. Lark, listen, thanks very much. An absolutely intriguing conversation. I mean, really, you know, we kind of went, you know, we went into things a bit deep, but we, you know, people need to kind of look there. We have to go into the deep end a bit to figure stuff out. And, communitarianism, we're going to definitely get you back on and talk more about this, because this to me is the ultimate new world order as far as I can see.
We're gonna beat these bastards, Breiser.
Oh, we will, of course we will. You know, once we stay positive and know what we're at and know what we're confronting, we can beat them. I mean, I don't give a shit about this system anymore. I've had enough. I've drawn a line in the sand. You know?
Yeah, good for you.
But I mean, I still have to indulge in it every now and again, you know? And but it's the best I can do at this moment in time. But, you know, at least if I can wake people up. And people, I'm beginning to see it now. People are beginning to respond, at least respond, instead of that usual, the shutters coming down type of thing. People are beginning to see it a little bit now. So we just keep going. We keep, you know, keep cracking on, and let's see where we go. And we're on the right path. And at the end of the day, I think this is a war. This is a war between good and evil. And I think I'm on the side of good. You're on the side of good, Graham, and everybody in the chat room. You know, we all want to live happily and do our own thing, and not have this nonsense confronting us day after day. So there we go.
Well, I'm convinced that I've been amongst the good guys today, and so I appreciate you, asking me to visit with y'all today.
Great, thank you, Lark, very much indeed. We'll definitely get you on maybe in a month or two, and we'll talk more. Okay.
All right. Well, very good.
Okay, so we'll leave it there, folks. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks to everyone in the chat. I got to list off the names in the chat. We got Blackbird 9, Frederick. How are you, sir? Good to see you again. We got Blau Ocean. We got Darkness Dreamer, Detox the Kool-Aid. That's our good friend Tim Sheehan. How are you, man? Hope to see you over in Ireland soon. Fake War, Frontreal, Froz 83, Graham Hart. Who the hell is he? Never heard of him before. Coco Puffs, Windmiller, and Zaddy Mom 1. Listen, thanks very much, everyone. And we got 7 Anons, whoever they are. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week. And talk to you again then. Okay, so take care, folks. Good night to you, and have a good week.
The Goyim know.